Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Anti-Asian hate crimes have been on the rise since the outbreak of COVID. What is at its roots? And how should the Department of Justice prosecute hate crimes in terrorism? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Violence against Asian American and Pacific Islanders, or AAIP, has largely gone unreported in the United States. This changed this week with the murder of 8 people, including at least 6 Asian American workers in Atlanta. On today's show, we will explore the roots of these crimes, the nature of hate crimes against the AAPI population, and what it means for a better understanding of the nature of hate crimes in the United States. Our guest is Brian Levin. He is the director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism and professor of criminal justice at California State University, San Bernardino. He is co-author of the book, The Limits of Dissent, and co-author of the publications, Reports to the Nation, Hate Crimes Rise in the U.S. Cities and Counties in Time of Division and Foreign Interference, and Posing the Why Question, Understanding the Perpetration of Racially Motivated Violence and Harassment. Professor Levin, thank you for joining us. It's the first question. We've gotten a lot of reports about hate crimes, acts of violence against Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders, particularly this week, but certainly over the course of the last few months. Is it actually increasing? Is the reporting that this is increasing accurate? And what's the nature of some of these crimes?
We've seen an increase actually since hate crimes bottomed in 2014, during the Obama administration. The FBI has collected data on this for almost 3 decades, but we have usable data basically going back to 92. The worst year for anti-Asian hate crime was in 1996, when there were 355. Interestingly enough, that was also the worst year for another type of racial hate crime, hate crimes against African Americans. At least in that instance, it was the worst year for African Americans as a proportion of all hate crimes. Listen to this. In 1996, African Americans constituted 42% of all hate crimes. However, by 2019, which is the last year that we have available FBI data, African Americans constituted only 26%. And what we've seen, unfortunately, has been a rotation in various years. And sometimes these rotations can last multiple years of different groups. So, for instance, a little over a decade ago, anti-Latino hate crime had a high plateau for about 4 years and then declined when unemployment went down, some of the horrendous political rhetoric around various bills, including one in Arizona. And also the number of undocumented people crossing the southern border declined. So we saw a big decline in anti-Latino, but then they went up again a couple of years ago. Interestingly enough, middle of the last decade, anti-Muslim hate crimes hit a head and shoulder peak. And while the highest number that were reported were about 307, which was less than the 480, which came during 2001. But interestingly enough, even though the overall anti-Muslim hate crime numbers did not exceed that terrible year of 2001, which is also the worst year for hate crime overall, assaults beat 2001 in 2 of those 3 years in the mid-decade. Then we saw hate crimes against Muslims decline. Although again, they did not decline to the previous levels. And we saw in the following years, anti-Latino and anti-Semitic go up. Then in 2020, we don't have FBI data, but our data showed something really interesting, and just bear with me. We showed in 16 of the largest cities, and I don't know, maybe it's about 13, 14% of the American population, you know, close enough for government work, right? Anyway, 122 anti-Asian hate crimes in only 16 cities. To put that in perspective, for the whole country, in 2019, the FBI counted 158, and that was an increase.
Actually, to follow up that question then, is there anything other than the fact that these are coming from just a handful of cities? Are there regions of the country where we see many more hate crimes? And is it just simply correlated with the amount of the population living in that area. So obviously you expect more anti-Asian American hate crimes in cities with large Asian American populations. Is that the best way to explain it, or is there something else going on with respect to the distribution?
I think that's pretty good. We noticed basically the Boston to Philly metroplex and the West Coast, we saw quite a bit, but we also saw spikes in other places. So there were cities that hadn't reported an anti-Asian hate crime for more than a year or so, start having them show up on the radar screen. The problem is reported hate crimes are going to be the smallest tip of the iceberg, because we have massive underreporting with respect to hate crime. And indeed, it wasn't until 2015 that the federal government found that a majority of hate crime victims actually do report their victimizations to police. But guess what? For communities like the Asian American community, probably the transgender community, and others, we have very depressed reporting levels, particularly when there are cultural barriers, linguistic barriers, and also with regard to law enforcement. What I can tell you is part of the problem is that we have a very uneven response to the virus of hate. And it's similar to that uneven response that we see with regard to COVID. In other words, in some places, the government is doing a good job, and in other places, they're not. One thing about chronology, if I could just throw that in, because we were talking about geography. First of all, we saw a 7% decline in overall hate crime. And anti-Asian, usually numerically for our reported hate crimes, reported to police, then reported by them to the FBI, have been very small. But we're looking for a probable record in New York City. And we could have a record as well. Why I think that? Well, first of all, we had 122 out of 16 cities. We actually have some more cities, but like cities like Long Beach, for instance, didn't count any for the last couple of years. You know, and people ask me, well, what about Atlanta? Atlanta only counted one hate crime in 2019, and it was a religion hate crime. So many places are doing a really bad job. Georgia itself counted 102, but that's still less than the city of Boston. In any event, here's an interesting chronology that we found. Because we hear a lot of talk about the president's statements and this and that. Around March 8th, Congressman Gosar used these stigmatizing terms, which I'm not going to use. We also saw Secretary Pompeo doing that as well. Then on March 16th, President Trump used these stigmatizing ethnic terms. And according to some of our friends who did some other research, who actually counted them all up, they said that there were at least 20 references by the president using these terms. During that time, we found an increase in hate search, and other folks have also found similar conditions. But I think it was around the 8th, 9th, and 10th of March of last year, March of 2020, that we started to see this stuff take off on Twitter and in search and social media before the president actually started using those stigmatizing terms. So we had like a little bunch come before he spoke and then some after. But let me point an interesting thing out real briefly. Yes, it did happen. Google it. On March 23rd, uncharacteristically, President Trump tweeted about tolerance and then at a presser spoke again about tolerance towards Asian Americans. I don't know if it's a coincidence, but that day a DHS report came out with a warning that Asian Americans faced a risk of being under attack. Unfortunately, that only lasted for one day, but can I tell you something? At least as far as our data can show, no anti-Asian hate crimes in New York or LA on March 23rd. That being said, when President Bush spoke 6 days after 9/11, hate crimes drop precipitously the next day and into the next year. And we've seen consistently, whether it was around Charlottesville or his Muslim ban, or even the day after the election, November 9, 2016, that was the worst day for hate crime going back to 2003. And November 2016 was the worst month going back to the first anniversary of 9/11, September 2002.
So the reporting that you're giving on some of the quantitative data about the nature of these hate crimes, it seems like, if I'm understanding it correctly, it's somewhat weakened by the fact that the government entities, the cities or the states, are the ones doing the reporting as to whether or not a crime constitutes a hate crime. And then kind of a broader question, what exactly do we mean by hate crime? As far as coding, you know, classifying, counting these crimes, what needs to be present to ensure that the crime qualifies as a hate crime? And I'm thinking in this Atlanta case, there's still a debate as to whether or not, is this a hate crime, is it not, based on what the perpetrator said was his motivation. Is that what's determining whether something is a hate crime? How do we go about determining whether something is a hate crime?
What an excellent question. And actually, the FBI has come out with over a dozen criteria, but they also talk about totality of the circumstances. Among the criteria is statements made by the perpetrator. Now, there have been reports in the international press that there were statements made by the perpetrator as he was committing these atrocities, but that hasn't been confirmed at all by the authorities in Georgia. So some of the things that the FBI says look for is not only statements by the perpetrator. And by the way, let me just say, I've been involved in writing appellate and Supreme Court briefs on issues like this. And in a lot of these cases, the defendants are always trying to say self-serving things. So like in 2000, in an important case about the burden of proof you need to bring a hate crime sentencing enhancer, as well as any enhancer, in that case, the court said, it can't just be a preponderance of the evidence, you know, just a slight tilt of the evidence. It has to be beyond a reasonable doubt. That bias motivation has to be established. So some of the other criteria that the FBI says to look at, you know, yes, statements by the perpetrator, but are there prior statements, for instance? What does the community feel? Is there some kind of significance about the location, the date? So I would be very careful about reliance on self-serving comments by someone who says things that might expose them to less legal liability by saying it, particularly when it may contradict some of the unconfirmed reports that we're getting. That being said, look, the fact that all these establishments were owned by Asian people, the majority of the people killed were Asian, I think weighs in that direction. Now, remember, for data collection purposes, it's a different type of standard than actually proving beyond a reasonable doubt at trial. So I guess the big question that I would ask to your audience, do you feel as of now, based on what's out there, that there is probable cause to charge it as a hate crime? And again, that being said, a lot of hate crime homicides are not prosecuted as such because of a variety of technical legal issues that we could discuss perhaps later.
Listen to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing the nature of hate crimes, the classification of hate crimes, and whether they're going up or down with Brian Levin of California State University, San Bernardino. So one of the challenges in prosecuting certain types of hate crimes, again, is trying to prove this intentionality. And I know it's been highlighted in recent days that the prosecuting or classifying anti-Asian American or Pacific Islander hate crime is a bit more challenging than, say, anti-Black or anti-Semitic hate crimes because the symbols that get attached to anti-Black hate crimes, usually there's a reference to a noose or a burning cross or something, or in the case of anti-Semitism, usually a swastika or some sort of symbol. That could be changing with the references to COVID and some of the different, you know, statements that you haven't said that I think we both understand, you know, the kinds of statements linking the virus to China and to Asian and Asian American communities. But how much is this a challenge when trying to classify something as a hate crime, the importance of having some sort of a symbol that usually signals that it's a hate crime?
There's an entity out there called TRAC, and what they found that state attorneys submitted more than 2,000 hate crimes over the last decade, but only 15% led to court cases. And we have consistently seen, and home gamers can look up the California Attorney General's report, most hate crimes in California are not prosecuted under hate crime statutes, unfortunately. And that is because, as you so aptly indicated, the burden of proof requires evidence beyond a reasonable doubt. That being said, you can still have slurs, obviously, but I think there are other other obstacles as well. And that is, in some cultures, it's considered a shameful to be a hate crime victim. In other instances, there are vulnerable victims within that community, elderly people or young people who might not be familiar with the criminal justice system. Additionally, there are oftentimes linguistic barriers and also fear that the authorities might do something to hurt them, because in many of the countries that people come from, the police aren't always your friend.
So again, I guess some of the challenge here is the self-reporting challenge. I know different government agencies, the LA County will release our annual report on hate crimes, but that's a political motivation, and it's driven by an expectation of voters that this is the kind of information that people would want. Is that why some of these municipalities, why some of these states are underreporting hate crimes? Is because, I mean, these are political positions, and there could be a political motivation to try to underrepresent or underreport hate crimes.
Oh, sure. Nobody wants to be the city of hate. But you know what? I just did a talk for Santa Clara County, and they showed a big spike in overall hate crime. But it's because they're doing a better job of getting them. Give you an example. Miami, Florida, the first 8 years of last decade, counted zero. Anaheim, I think, counted zero last year. Long Beach counted 18. So there's real variation, even in cities of similar population. And one thing that I found for some years, Orlando would count like single digits. Anaheim would count single digits, or like when I say single digits, I mean real single digits, zero, one, or two, right? And Hawaii wouldn't even participate in the FBI program. So I always used to joke, the happiest places on earth are ones where they cover up hate crimes. Or appear to be, anyway. We don't want to cast aspersions on folks. But there are significant issues. First of all, here in this state, we have some legislation that's up, AB 1126, to create an independent state of hate commission. Would love to see that. So that would get it out of the political realm, and we could hold hearings that would question folks and have subject matter experts in the community as well come in. Also, model policies. Hate crime reporting is not mandatory in the United States. And I think we need to change that. If you're going to get federal funds, you better not throw a bunch of zeros on a sheet. Interestingly enough, well over 85%, sometimes up to around 90% almost, of jurisdictions in the United States either don't report any hate crimes at all or affirmatively say we had zero. And so we saw cities like New Orleans for some years reporting like one, you know, and we saw cities in Texas reporting low double digits. Then we saw increases, but those increases weren't organic increases. It was because they were trying to do a better job. So here in California, there's another bill, AB 58 by Assemblyman Gabriel, the other one, 1126 on the hate commission stuff. But one of the things that we'd like to see are, like, for instance, mandatory model policies, mandatory reporting. And also we'd like to see police departments really coordinate with other government agencies, like who? Public Works, for instance. If there's a swastika on an underpass, we want to make sure police get a chance to photograph it before it's painted over. We also want to make sure the community is involved. And on the intake side, it's really important to have outreach. And that's why it's important for groups like LA County Human Relations Commission. Wonderful folks, deal with them all the time, friends for many years. They actually instituted like a 211 number. So if you're in LA and for some reason you want to call 911, I would call 911 too, but you can always call 211. So what you need is better outreach, things like the 211 system and these portals like our friends at Stop AAPI Hate did. That's important too. But what I'd like to see is some kind of state or national portal so that you could put in where you are, your zip code, for instance, and what happened to you, and then get a list of folks who you could call or who would help you out in addition, but also including law enforcement.
Now, kind of circling back to the nature of this seeming spike in hate crimes against Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders, I guess the first is to confirm that there actually, you know, it has been a spike. And is this pretty closely correlated then with world events? So, I mean, the narrative that we have is that coronavirus is leading to more hate crime against Asian Americans, that the, you know, the narratives about caravans were leading to spikes in hate crimes against the Latinx community. Is that pretty closely correlated, that events going on in the country are leading to these spikes in violence?
Yes, and I think there's at least three things. One is that catalytic event itself, right? But then there's a whole ecosystem and an industry that pushes division around that. So I think that in this intranet invective, we often see these things come along with several variables at once, right? So for instance, the catalytic event, social media and other types of invective discourse, which get it out, and messages from the top, particularly the President of the United States. Again, 6 days after 9/11, President Bush spoke of tolerance at the Islamic Center of DC. Hate crimes dropped precipitously the next day and into the next year. If I could just make a metaphor, the Wall Street Journal said, I have the worst metaphors of any academic, but then they keep calling. Anyway, and what I would say is, I think the catalytic event is like the spark that makes a wildfire out of the dry kindling. And I think like the social media invective and this other type of leadership invective, lower than the president and other folks, is more like a big gust of wind that drives that wildfire even worse. And then statements by people like a president can be either a fire hose or a gasoline hose. That's what I think the best metaphor is. So we see a combination of a catalytic event, invective in news and social media, and then statements by a president can make a real difference. That's why it was so important that when President Biden and Vice President Harris went to Atlanta, they both made clear statements condemning this kind of activity. Because I think in the eyes of some haters, silence is indeed consent. One last thing. There are different types of offenders. Our friends at Northeastern University, Jack McDevitt and Jack Levin, what they found is that there were at least three types of hate offenders. I think there's a fourth kind of mentally ill offender, and there's another fellow who thinks there's another type, the conflicted offender, like this biracial character in Boston some years ago who actually went out to hurt African-Americans, the conflicted offender. But anyway, let's get to the main ones. The thrill offender, oftentimes young people with no criminal records, they're intoxicated, often but not always operating in groups. And it's almost like a sporting event, a peer activity. We're defining our machismo and in-group cred by lashing out at an out-group so that that coalesces us closer. There's another type of offender called the defensive reactive offender. And they're responding to an incursion on turf or pride. So I interviewed a guy who was the first the first anti-Muslim hate offender after the Paris terror attacks. He had something to drink. He came home. He's living next door to a mosque. He watches a network on TV and he shoots up his neighbor's mosque. That's what we call the reactive defensive offender. And what Robin Williams of Cornell, not the comedian, but the deceased scholar, said, there is a printed circuit of stereotypes which identifies who's a legitimate target for aggression. And in these days, we have conspiracy theories around that and news events, but the switch gets turned on in different ways. For the thrill offender, what turns on that switch is a desire for peer validation and excitement and thrill. And they have relatively shallow prejudices, but they can still really hurt people, especially if they attack somebody and they deem or perceive the responsibility for the attack kind of diffused across the group. It's a lot easier to do bad things in mobs, right? The reactive defensive offender is usually older, and that switch is turned on, as I said, by either pride or turf incursion. And then the third type, that switch is always on, that neo-Nazi skinhead, that Klan person.
We've highlighted some of the responses to these hate crimes, you know, that you've indicated, the importance that political leadership speak authoritatively, the importance of getting good reporting so we understand the nature of the data. There's been quite a bit of an emphasis on the successful prosecution of hate crimes. In dealing with these sort of individual acts or the building of transparency with communities, it's extremely important that communities view the legal system as promoting justice as well as their protection. My question is, are there other tools, conversations that we have, including truth commissions, inclusion in the history books, these narratives? Because I know part of the response to what happened in Atlanta is a recognition that it really is not atypical of American history, but sadly, these types of crimes have actually been fairly consistent with American history, but you wouldn't see terribly many references to that in American history books.
Or in LA history books. 10% of Asian immigrants in LA, well, in the 19th century, were massacred, and you never hear about that. The Chinese Exclusions Act, a little bit. But unfortunately, a lot of our Asian brothers and sisters have suffered in silence. And one of my friends who heads up in Asian American advocacy groups, I think aptly said, we're not going to prosecute our way out of this. We're not going to prosecute our way out of this.
And so sort of last question then, if you were recommending, you know, to the Justice Department, what recommendations would you give to try to use the power of the federal government as a means to address this spike in hate crimes?
The federal government can provide a lot of assistance. First of all, I'd like to see federal legislation making hate crime reporting mandatory. Here in the state, I'd like to see model policies become mandatory. Also, the Community Relations Service, which was created by the Civil Rights Act of 1964, is a non-enforcement agency that mediates community racial tensions. And actually, that mission was expanded later under the Obama administration. I also want to see greater help for human relations commissions, like here in LA. They do a wonderful job. So there are a variety of things that the federal government can do. And under the Shepard-Byrd Hate Crime Act, which became law in 2010, there is aid that can come from federal authorities like the FBI or ATF, especially for small jurisdictions. So there's a significant role that the federal government can play. But you know, one of the things I think the federal government can do, frankly, is under Janet Reno, each federal district, we're in the Central District, it is about like, you know, half a dozen counties here in Southern California, you know, judicial districts, let's have these hate crime working groups. Let's really, you know, keep them up. One of the things that I did in 92, 93, I did a best practices study that was published in Stanford Law and Policy Review. And there were certain things that we found. Some things should be done at the local and state level, particularly with regard to outreach, model policies, a message from the top. But the federal government has a role to play. Sometimes that can be just with backing up local authorities who might not have the type of investigative resources and personnel. But also, I think that we should have the federal government assist in getting training up to snuff. I participated about 30 years ago for many, many years, well over a decade, with what we called a train the trainer. And it came out of the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center. And we would get a cadre of subject matter experts from both US and Canada. And we travel throughout North America to different states. But what we would also always do is get local subject matter experts, particularly from local agencies, to co-present with us. And that was really effective and very cost efficient. I'd like to see the federal government spearhead that, because that's something, an entity that can travel around that would have economies of scale that a small community may not have.
We've been discussing hate crimes, in particular hate crimes against Asian American and Pacific Islander communities. And our guest has been Brian Levin. He's the director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism and professor of criminal justice at California State University, San Bernardino. He's the co-author of the book, The Limits of Dissent, and co-author of publications, Report to the Nation, Hate Crimes Rise in U.S. Cities and Counties in the Time of Division and Foreign Interference, and Posing the Why Question, Understanding the Perpetration of Racially Motivated Violence and Harassment. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me. And one last thing, call your state legislators and tell them to pass these assembly bills like 58 and 1126. And also call your federal legislators and say, hey, we want the data collection law passed. And we also want this newly proposed legislation related to COVID and anti-Asian hate crime passed as well.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
When we come back, Merrick Garland, the new attorney general, is an expert in domestic terrorism. How might things change with the Department of Justice under his leadership? Stay with us. You are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. A new attorney general will lead to new priorities. How should and might Merrick Garland's Department of Justice confront hate crimes and terrorism? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. The Department of Justice has a new head with the confirmation of Merrick Garland as attorney general. One of Garland's strengths is his experience and involvement in the successful prosecution of terrorism in the United States, most notably with Timothy McVeigh's attack on the Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City. How much should and will the Department of Justice focus on domestic terrorism, and how might this campaign proceed? Our guest is Chuck Rosenberg. He is senior counsel at Kroll and Mooring's Washington, D.C. office and a member of the firm's White Collar and Regulatory Enforcement Group. He served as the acting administrator of the Drug Enforcement Administration and as chief of staff and senior counselor to FBI Director James Comey. Chuck Rosenberg, thank you for joining us. First off, Garland's background in the prosecution of terrorism in the United States was cited as one of the reasons why President Biden nominated him. How do you imagine a Department of Justice led by Merrick Garland might change what the DOJ's position has been recently on prosecuting terrorism?
Well, I hope he'll do a couple of things, Doug. And by the way, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to join you. I hope he'll do a couple of things. I hope he'll pay a lot of attention to this. We've always had a terrorism problem in this country. And by that, I mean a domestic terrorism problem. We've always had hate groups. You know, we've always had these vile individuals who live in the shadows of our society. Never before has a president of the United States, in this case, a former president, given sustenance to these groups. And so they are, I am afraid, more prevalent. They are emboldened. And it's going to take a lot of time and attention and resources to push them back into the shadows of American life. And so I think Merrick Garland, as you said, brings some experience with these types of groups and these types of cases. He also has an FBI that understands the problem well and has been working it for years. And I think it can use a shift in resources and more attention.
What does that mean in practical terms, in the sense that the acts committed by these groups are themselves crimes? So prosecuting them as crimes of terrorism or crimes of hate, and we can differentiate the two of those in just a moment, how does that differ from just prosecuting based on the violence of the act?
Yeah, it's a great question, and actually one that's very relevant right now. There actually is no federal crime of domestic terrorism. There is a federal crime related to international terrorism, for instance, providing material support, personnel, money, supplies, training to a designated international terrorist group, Al-Qaeda, ISIS, and the like. There is no analogous federal crime for domestic terrorism. And so, take an example. Dylan Roof, a neo-Nazi white supremacist in 2015, kills 9 Black Americans in their church in Charleston, South Carolina. To your point, it's a crime. It is a state crime of murder. Murder is illegal in all 50 states. And so we don't have difficulty finding a crime to prosecute these people. We sometimes have difficulty finding a federal crime to prosecute them. And so my view is that we ought to have a domestic terrorism crime in the federal code because there's a moral equivalency gap. We ought to call these people exactly what they are, not just murderers, that's a state thing by and large, but also terrorists, which I think ought to be a federal thing.
And sort of at the core of this then is the question of the intentionality of the act, that the murder is the crime, but should there be greater attention, greater sentencing, et cetera, if the murder was to serve a political purpose or some, you know, purpose driven by hate?
Sure. So you could imagine a scenario coming out of the January 6th riot at the Capitol, where a couple of things are happening simultaneously. You know, several different crimes are being committed. They're assaulting a police officer. They've murdered a police officer. but they've also stormed the Capitol in order to interfere with the electoral count. And so one act, the one we easily understand, the murder of a police officer, is a crime. The other was motivated perhaps by an ideology that we loathe or don't quite fully comprehend, but was intended, you know, to overthrow the outcome of a fair election, or was intended to thwart the government or interfere with its operations. You have to look at the intentionality. You're 100% correct. Sometimes more difficult to discern, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't have a statute on the books to criminalize it in federal court.
And then would that typically result in longer sentences, or just is the question what we're actually calling what's criminal?
Well, I think both. Again, going to my point about the moral equivalency gap, I think we ought to call terror exactly what it is, terror. Dylann Roof, in my view, is a terrorist. In the eyes of the law, he is a murderer under South Carolina code. In my world, in the world in which I lived, and you introduced me as someone who worked at the FBI and at the DEA, I was also a federal prosecutor for many, many years in the Eastern District of Virginia, both as an assistant U.S. attorney and as the United States attorney. I think what we call somebody matters a lot. You know, the murder victims of Dylann Roof are victims of terrorism. I think that's important. Dylann Roof is a terrorist. I think that's important. But technically, under federal law right now, we don't have that statute. And so to your question, what we call them matters and how we sentence them matters. So let's go back to your question about, what are the consequences of being a terrorist? One is that we label someone. The labels matter. Dylann Roof is a terrorist. The other is that there are sentencing enhancements based on whether or not perhaps you targeted somebody based on race or nationality or religion or gender, or that if you acted out of an attempt or an ideology to overthrow the United States government, there could be sentencing enhancements. All that could be part of the sentencing scheme. So I think it matters for both of those reasons, to signal loudly and clearly that these people are terrorists and their acts are terrorist acts, and to make sure that punishment is enhanced when you act in that way.
Now, when I think of federal statute focused on terrorism, my own background in international relations, I have a specific image in mind. And kind of what's central in that is the role of organization, that the Department of Justice and specifically the FBI viewing these acts, not necessarily as isolated incidents, but wanting to understand that there's some sort of an organization attached to that. So ultimately, I guess two related questions. The first is how central should unearthing the organization be versus the actual prosecution of each of these cases? And secondly, how does that alter the way that we view each individual case, if there's actually some sort of a group that the person is working with?
Right. So you want to understand all of that. You want to understand if there is an organization, how it's funded, where their members are, where they reside, where they act, where they work, and how different parts of the organization may connect with one another. Really important stuff. However, that said, you also have lone wolves, lone actors. Some people might be motivated by the ideology of an organization, but not be a part of it. They might have read their hateful literature online and picked up a weapon and gone and hurt or killed somebody as a result. And the organization doesn't even know about this person or that they inspired them in some way. In some ways, it's the difference, if I can use an international terrorism analogy, it's the difference between Al-Qaeda, a very hierarchical organization, with orders and plans and operations and strategy that come top down, and ISIS, which basically franchises terror and using social media encourages its adherents and followers to simply kill in its name. They don't care who does what on behalf of ISIS, as long as they do something on behalf of ISIS. So Al-Qaeda has that central hierarchical structure and ISIS does not. They're both virulent and dangerous terrorist organizations.
I would imagine then one of the core questions here is a law enforcement question, that if the focus on prosecuting domestic terrorism is at least partially focused on the organizations that are attached to that, understanding those organizations, breaking up those organizations becomes a powerful deterrent mechanism. Perhaps the most important thing about being a part of that organization is that, or is it more about the nature of the prosecution themselves, the types of sentences that could potentially be handed down?
Well, so if you're asking me with my federal prosecutor hat on, I would say the second thing, right? Dismantling the organizations and holding their members accountable for their acts. That said, a lot of these organizations also find themselves on the wrong end of civil lawsuits brought by aggrieved citizens, and properly so. And so if the organization has assets, they have a meeting house, they have property, they have a bank account, they have something, you know, sort of tangible, and they lose a civil suit, that's something that, you know, private citizens can win, can be awarded. So there's lots of different ways to attack them. Some on the civil side and through private litigation, some on the criminal side when the U.S. attorney, or in some cases, the state brings a criminal action. But to your point, Doug, understanding the organization is absolutely critical. Now, again, members may freelance, others may, or non-members may simply be inspired, but it's always really important to understand the organization and how it funds itself and how it operates and how it communicates. Because as a prosecutor, I'm also looking for a conspiracy. I'm looking for concerted conduct. I'm looking to see if two or more people agreed to do something that the law forbids. Because conspiracy prosecutions can be very powerful. It sweeps in lots of conduct over lots of time from lots of different people. And it is a in the prosecutor's quiver, it is a very important arrow.
Is the statute that would empower prosecutions under these conspiracies, is this the RICO statute, you know, that was used to help to break up organized crime?
It could be, theoretically. I mean, there's lots of conspiracies in the federal criminal code. And RICO is a bit of a complex and cumbersome statute because there are certain prerequisites you would have to prove in court, but a very, very powerful tool to your point. I was actually thinking of a simpler conspiracy statute in the federal code. Title 18 of the United States Code, Section 371, is the general conspiracy statute. If you conspire with another person to violate any other federal law, that is a violation of the statute I just cited. And using that, you have advantages in terms of adducing proof, and using co-conspirator statements, and in sweeping in lots of conduct to prove the crime. So your point about RICO is a really important one, and that is a tool, but there are also very powerful general conspiracy statutes that can help a prosecutor in this case.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing the Department of Justice prosecuting terrorism, extremism, and hate crimes with Chuck Rosenberg. Chuck was the acting administrator of the Drug Enforcement Agency and the chief of staff and senior counselor to FBI Director James Comey. I'd like to also draw upon your expertise on a couple of process questions. The first, you have a background experience as a federal prosecutor. How much independence do each of the individual prosecutors or the different offices have from the Attorney General and from the central leadership in the Department of Justice? Is there a lot of discretion given to the federal prosecutors, or is it pretty closely directed by the Attorney General?
Both, depending on the case. So in your average case, a bank robbery, a crime of violence, a fraud, the prosecutors in the field, the assistant U.S. attorneys, and I was one, have enormous discretion, and properly so. The Department of Justice, both in terms of prosecutors and agents, is a deployed army, if you will, Doug. The overwhelming majority of the work gets done in the field. And it would be, it's inconceivable that an attorney general could manage other than a very, very, very small fraction of it. So why did I say both? Because on the highest profile cases, on the most significant matters, the attorney general will be briefed regularly and will want to talk to the United States attorney in the field to understand how the case is progressing, or if more resources are necessary, or to weigh in on charging decisions. But an attorney general, any attorney general, can only do that in a small fraction of the thousands and thousands of cases that are brought around the country.
And also, and this, you know, came up in a segment last week talking about the independence of the attorney general from the presidency itself. How much independence does the Department of Justice have? And is it correct to say that the recent trend was to move against the independence of the Justice Department, and that there's an expectation that under Merrick Garland, the Justice Department is going to try to assert a bit more independence than, say, his previous couple of predecessors under President Trump?
That's such an important question. And I'm really glad you asked me that. So first, the Department of Justice by design, has an extraordinarily thin political layer, which is actually a very good thing, not a bad thing. And I often ask people when they ask me about this issue, whether they know how many people work at the FBI, and many don't, but the answer is 37,000 or so. And then I ask, how many of those 37,000 do you think are politically appointed? And they're often surprised to hear the answer, which is one, just one. In the US attorney community, and I was an assistant US attorney and the US attorney, in every US attorney's office in the country, there is at most one political appointee. And so by design, it is a career prosecutor, career agent heavy organization. So does the attorney general have independence? Should the attorney general have independence? What did it normally look like? Were the last 4 years aberrational? It's a complicated answer, but I think I can sort of summarize it in the following way. If you're talking about the criminal enforcement mechanisms of the United States Department of Justice, who is investigated, who's charged, who's prosecuted, who's tried, who's sentenced, the Department of Justice must have independence. It's so, so dangerous if it does not. And we saw in the previous administration, the president, calling out enemies and favoring allies and issuing pardons on behalf of allies, and the attorney general weighing in on cases being litigated in the field to favor allies of the president. Extraordinarily damaging, extraordinarily dangerous. On the other hand, the attorney general is a member of the president's cabinet, and he is a subservient official to the president within the executive branch. And so properly answers to the president on questions of policy and the like. So is there a legitimate role for the Justice Department and the White House and the president to interact? Absolutely. On policy, on legislation, on the appointment of judges and the like. But when you talk about independence of the United States Department of Justice, what you're really asking, I think, Doug, and the most important thing is the independence of the criminal enforcement work. If that gets corrupted, we're all in danger. And I often say, we have to be two things in the Department of Justice. We have to be actually fair, and we have to be perceived as actually fair. If you're only one of those two things, you're losing. And I think in the last 4 years, the Department of Justice was perceived as not being actually fair, even if it was. And again, because the overwhelming majority of the work gets done in the field, I am completely confident that the overwhelming majority of the work was actually fair. But when we see the president and the attorney general interfering in certain high profile cases, we lose faith in the system. And that is deeply distressing.
And along the similar vein, one relationship that has certainly come under greater scrutiny is the relationship between the Department of Justice and specifically the attorney general and the FBI. I know with James Comey's memoirs, this issue has certainly come to a head. And in really the recent week to 10 days, the current FBI director has been very much asserting an FBI's independence rather than being tied to previous administrations. So I guess first is exactly how independent is the FBI from the attorney general? And has that relationship altered in recent years?
Well, so if you look at the organizational chart, the answer is in black and white. The Attorney General runs the Justice Department. The number two person will be Lisa Monaco. The deputy attorney general is the chief operating officer on a day-to-day basis. And then the DEA and the ATF and the Marshal Service and the Bureau of Prisons and the FBI are all component agencies within the Department of Justice. And so the director of the FBI reports to the deputy attorney general of the United States. Could not be more clear. But this goes back to the thing we just discussed. Are the political appointees, and both the deputy attorney general and the attorney general are typically political appointees, whether it's a Republican or Democratic president, interfering in the criminal enforcement work of the FBI, because that's where it gets dangerous. The FBI, and I worked there twice, once on the staff of Jim Comey and once on the staff of Bob Mueller right after 9/11, prides itself on its independence. That is true to an extent, but it is not a truly independent organization. It's part of the Justice Department, and the director, like the person who runs ATF or DEA, answers to political superiors. That's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. They just can't interfere in the criminal enforcement work for improper reasons. I know Chris Wray, the current director of the FBI. Chris is a good and decent and smart and honorable man, and I think he's leading the FBI in the right way.
If you were recommending to Merrick Garland what should be the priorities of the new Department of Justice, in particular on these issues of the prosecution of extremism, of hate crimes, et cetera, what would be some of your recommendations?
Well, you know, I read recently or reread recently the statement he gave to the Senate Judiciary Committee before his confirmation hearing. And he said himself that he's going to focus on terrorism, both in its international and domestic flavors and in civil rights enforcement. And also he's going to seek to restore morale in the Department of Justice, which I think took a hit, and reinforce norms, including what we just talked about, to make sure that there's no interference from the president or White House officials in their enforcement work. I think he has his priorities exactly right. It may make sense to shift some resources to the FBI, perhaps, or to seek more resources for the FBI to make sure that it has what it needs to fully investigate domestic terrorism cases. I also wouldn't be shocked if the Attorney General, and I would recommend this because that was your question, sought legislation to close that gap we had talked about earlier, that moral equivalency gap, so that there is a domestic terrorism statute in the federal code. The other thing, though, Doug, that I've noticed, and I've worked for many different attorneys general, including on the staff of two of them, is that whatever priorities they set almost always get overtaken by events, things they never could have envisioned. It's an exceedingly difficult job. And so, you know, I think Mike Tyson's line about having a fight plan until you get punched in the mouth applies here. It's a very difficult job. Things change rapidly. At the outset, it's good to have a vision for what you want to do and to articulate that vision to the men and women in your department. But things will change. They always do.
And then speaking of which, two ways in which the Justice Department has been punched in the mouth by events. I'd love to get your thoughts on these as sort of a last question. The first is the priority of prosecuting those who participated in the January 6th attack on the Capitol, and then the attacks, the murders in Atlanta this week. The first, clearly, Department of Justice plays a significant role. The second one is kind of an interesting question. Should the Department of Justice play a significant role? What do you imagine and what would you recommend that the Attorney General's office do in those two high-profile cases?
Let's take the second one first, the heinous attack in Atlanta and the murder of Asian American citizens. I don't think exclusively Asian American citizens were murdered, but certainly the majority of the victims were Asian American. Whether or not the Department of Justice ends up prosecuting that case, they absolutely should be investigating that case. They should be giving whatever help, resources, personnel that they can to state and local partners. They should be looking to see if it was, in fact, a hate crime. As we speak, Doug, I don't think that we know that yet, but we absolutely have to look at it. it's a horrific murder, a horrific set of facts. If it turns out to be a hate crime, there are federal statutes that can be employed to bring the case into federal court and to prosecute the defendant federally. If it turns out not to be motivated by their race or nationality, it's still a murder and can be prosecuted in the state courts of Georgia, much like Dylann Roof was prosecuted in the state courts of South Carolina. So, you know, should the Justice Department be involved? Absolutely at the investigative phase and possibly at the prosecutive phase, depending on how facts develop. With respect to the riot at the Capitol, you see a massive federal response. I believe that the U.S. Attorney's Office in the District of Columbia, and I don't have the latest number, but has charged more than 300 people. They're looking at conspiracies, which we talked about earlier. They're looking at all different sorts of lone wolves and individual actors. They're following the money. They're looking at the structures. They're looking at communications. My sense, as somebody who used to be in the Justice Department, but now watches it and admires it from the sidelines, is that they're doing it right.
We've been discussing the priorities of the Merrick Garland Department of Justice, in particular, the emphasis on prosecuting terrorism and hate crimes. Our guest has been Chuck Rosenberg. He is senior counsel in Kroll & Moring's Washington, D.C. office and a member of the firm's white-collar regulatory enforcement group. He served as the acting administrator of the Drug Enforcement Administration and as the chief of staff and senior counselor to FBI Director James Comey. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you to our guest and to you for listening. The Scholar's Circle team includes Doug Becker and Lillian Ng, contributing hosts, Ankine Agassian and Melissa Chiprin, managing producers, Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Tim Page and Mike Hurst, engineers and technical support. I'm Maria Armudian, and we'll see you next week.